Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick.
It is an honor to serve with you and to welcome you to the first day of the 116th of the United States House of Representatives.
2019 started with a blue wave arriving at the U.S. Capitol in Washington and the Michigan Capitol in Lansing.
There is no place in the world like our state, and no people in the world like Michiganders. And no question that Michigan has as much God-given potential as any place on earth.
We will begin with Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who you just heard making part of her inauguration speech on New Year's Day. Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth covered that and some of the governor's first actions, and she joins me in studio now. Welcome, Shayna.
Hi, Reginald.
First, Governor Whitmer gave about a 12-minute inauguration speech. What stood out to you?
Well, I think the number one thing that stood out to me was how cold it was, although it's outside on the Capitol steps, although I've been told that we got lucky and it wasn't as cold as it has been in previous years, but it was hard to pay attention when your feet were numb. But she did a really good job of really reiterating her main points over and over again. And really, the big message there is bipartisanship. We got to work together if we want to get anything done.
We may belong to different parties, but we are all here today for the same reason. We are proud Michiganders, first and foremost.
Shayna, the governor talked about bipartisanship, but the reality is she has a Republican state house to work with. Can we really expect cooperation between the governor's office and the legislature?
I mean, that really remains to be seen. I mean, right now we are still in a position where the legislature has not started yet. So it's easy. Everything's kind of theoretical at this point. So it's kind of easy for Republican leaders to be like, yes, of course, we want to work together. We agree that we should be building bridges, which is, you know, we're going to build bridges, not walls, was a big part of Whitmer's speech. And it remains to be seen, though, where the lines in the sand are going to be. There are some issues that incoming Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey and incoming Speaker of the House Lee Chatfield have said were no-goes on these things. Those include, you know, taxes. There are some things that Republicans are just not going to want to do. And those, in some cases, are things that Whitmer has said might need to be done in order to do some of the major things as part of her agenda, such as fixing the roads, cleaning up infrastructure, things like that. So right now, we are still very much in the sort of hypothetical bubble, the sort of, yes, let's all work together bubble. But we will see what happens on January 9th when the legislature gavels in and they have plans to be in session every week until spring break.
We are talking with Shayna Roth about Governor Whitmer's first week. She began signing several directives the very next day. How do some of those directives impact state workers?
I mean, they're really all kind of focused on state workers more for the most part. These are directives that do things like prevent them from using private email for state business. This is sort of a common practice, but she wants to essentially make it a specific official order. They also do things like reporting requirements. And it says that if you see some sort of imminent threat to health or the public welfare, that you need to report that. And there is now, you know, this one of the executive directives says that you have to report that, and also that that report needs to go through the proper channels and needs to be worked out. And this one was in large response to things that have been going on at the Department of Environmental Quality. There's reports of low morale. There's been a lot of criticism over how the department handled the Flint water crisis. The emerging contaminants of PFAS are really starting to come to light. So this is her basically saying, we want government to be open and transparent, but we also want to make sure that it works for the people and that state employees are empowered to report on things that they're concerned about.
Lastly, I understand that Governor Whitmer will deliver her State of the State address not in January, but perhaps later.
Yeah, from what I'm hearing, it looks like it's going to be early February. This is a little bit later than we've been seeing with Snyder. He, at least the last few of them, have been in January. So this is going to give her, this kind of works both ways. On one hand, it gives her a chance to really get settled in, to really kind of think about what she wants to say, and also to kind of test the waters because the legislature will have been in session for, you know, at least a month at that point. So there's that, which could be a benefit to her, but also it's possible that the legislature could come in and essentially start passing bills and start sending stuff to her desk and really get the ball rolling before she even sets out her agenda in this state of the state.
Well, I know one person who will be there, and that is you.
That is me.
Thank you, Shayna Roth, our Capitol correspondent, for reporting on Gretchen Whitmer's first week as governor. And thank you for joining us in studio.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR. The spotlight was not only on Governor Whitmer. Several other leaders also took their oaths on January 1st. I'm joined now by WKAR's new politics and government reporter, Abigail Sinsky, who also covered the inauguration. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
We're going to focus on two other statewide officials, starting with Attorney General Dana Nessel. Abigail, what stood out for you?
Attorney General Nessel's remarks were really popular with the crowd. She seemed to get a lot of response from people. It was a history-making day, and she kind of called upon that before Lieutenant Governor Gilchrist was added to Governor Whitmer's ticket as her lieutenant governor. This was the first time that Michigan had seen an all-female ticket, and Nessel referenced that in her inaugural remarks during the speech.
2 years ago, I stood on these same steps after marching with thousands of other women demanding equality and representation with the pledge that together we would create a state government that would hear and understand the voices of women in Michigan. So looking around here, seeing who's being sworn in today, I'd say that worked out pretty well.
So that's kind of a cheeky recognition there by Nessel that, you know, she had decided to run for office or was really motivated by when she was at the Capitol during the Women's March, and just kind of a nod to just how many of the statewide executives were female. And then also the fact that Nessel is the state's first openly gay statewide official. So her two sons and her wife were there standing beside her at inauguration. But the thing that really stood out, I would say, most from her speech was actually when she decided to call upon how she wanted the Attorney General's office and Michigan's government to really serve Michiganders. She said she wanted Michigan's government to be a government that cared about them again.
Irrespective of income, race, geography, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, or gender identity. We are all Michiganders, and we are all entitled to equal protection under the law.
And, you know, that's something that's really important for Nessel, regardless of, like she was saying, identity, sexual orientation, gender, equal protection under the law for Michiganders. She actually rose to kind of the legal spotlight and the political spotlight in Michigan, not only in her role as Wayne County prosecutor, but also bringing a case forward before the state of Michigan and representing a lesbian couple so they could both file their names on the adoption papers of their children. And that case ended up being a referendum on Michigan's ban against gay marriage, and eventually that was overturned in 2015. And that's kind of when Nessel's political star began to rise.
So in her opening week as Attorney General, what has Dana Nessel accomplished so far?
The thing that she's accomplished so far was actually more of a comment on something that Governor Whitmer had done. Governor Whitmer had requested that Attorney General Nessel review the legislation that was just passed regarding Line 5. Now, the legislation that was passed in the lame duck session that Governor Snyder signed on his way out basically allows for the Mackinac Straits Corridor Authority to build a tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac for part of an oil pipeline that runs under the Straits of Mackinac. This was something that both Nessel and Whitmer were vocal against in their campaign, and it was a campaign promise for both of them that they did not want this to happen. And Nessel has pledged that she's eager to review Governor Whitmer's request and issue a legal opinion. She did not say if there's a specific timeline or did not give any specific timeline on when a legal opinion would come from her office, but she also encouraged anyone to submit memos or briefs who has, you know, a stake in the game or concern in the issue.
We are speaking with WKAR politics and government reporter Abigail Sinsky about the inauguration. Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson was also sworn in. I remember her speech being the shortest.
Yeah, her speech was just over 2 minutes. It was the shortest out of all of the people who gave inaugural remarks on the dais of Governor Whitmer, Lieutenant Governor Gilchrist, and Attorney General Nessel. And she really emphasized that she wanted to take Michigan from worst to first in transparency and accountability, something that she really drove home throughout her whole campaign for Secretary of State and plans to continue in her tenure as Secretary of State.
I am ready to work to make us a national leader in fair and accessible elections, to ensure that our legislative districts are drawn by citizens in a nonpartisan manner. I am ready to secure our democracy and to work with all of you to take Michigan from worst to first in transparency, ethics, and accountability.
Yeah, so astute political listeners and observers may have caught that reference in her inaugural remarks to Proposition 2 and 3, initiatives that changed voting and elections in Michigan. I actually spoke to Secretary Benson her second day in office, and she told me a little bit about how excited she was to take office at this time where elections in Michigan and access to voting would really be changing for Michiganders. And she kind of outlined her plans for me.
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled that I get to take office at this unique moment in our democracy with all of these initiatives that have just been passed into law. Early voting, no reason absentee voting, online voter registration, automatic voter registration, and then the audits that were also in the Proposal 3, the Promote the Vote initiative. So I'm ready to make sure we're implementing each of those changes with an eye towards making it easier to vote and harder to cheat, protecting the access of the process and the security of the process.
Okay, and we know that interview will air Monday on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. So your first inauguration, Shana talked about it being cold. How was it in your experience?
It was definitely blustery up on the media riser. I actually called people from the National Weather Service in Grand Rapids just seeking validation for how cold that I felt. And they let me know that it went from feeling like with a wind chill, 24 degrees to 19 degrees from 10:30 to noon when we were all out there covering the inauguration. So it was very cold, but I felt like justifiably cold. But everyone that I've since talked to in state government has informed me that this was not actually the coldest inauguration and others have been much worse.
Right. January 1st in Michigan. You never know. Thank you for joining us, Abigail Sinsky, our new politics and government reporter. Thank you for talking with us about some of the other points of the inauguration.
My pleasure.
This is Current State from WKAR.
Look at all of the countries that have walls, and they work 100%. It's never going to change. A wall is a wall.
It's well, we can go through this all, back and forth. Mm-hmm. No. How many more times can we say no? Nothing for the wall.
That was President Trump and House Speaker Pelosi still far apart on the federal government shutdown. The newly minted House Democratic majority pushed through a series of spending bills on Thursday to reopen the government. But President Trump says he will not sign anything without billions of dollars for a border wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Here in Michigan, we have two examples of how the shutdown is really hitting home for federal employees here. First, Taylor Wisner reports people in northern Michigan are donating goods to members of the U.S. Coast Guard.
Coast Guard workers got paid on Monday, but they're not sure when they'll get their next paycheck. So some people are stepping up to help them. Daniel Summers works for Bayside Market in Traverse City. He says people have given thousands of dollars and donated deli meats and produce for the Coast Guard families.
We just want them to know that we care about them. I mean, this is a very much a water-based community, and you know, they're always there watching and trying to keep us safe.
The U.S. Coast Guard says it is investigating whether employees can receive the donations without violating federal ethics laws. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Taylor Wisner.
Politicians continue their standoff on border wall funding, and caught up in the shutdown, historic agreements between the U.S. and Native American tribes, including right here in Michigan. NPR's Audie Cornish spoke with a member of a nation from the Upper Peninsula earlier this week on All Things Considered.
Treaties signed generations ago guaranteed federal funds for health care and education in those communities. With the shutdown, that money has stopped. Aaron Payman is tribal chairman of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Their tribal lands are on Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So to start, give us some examples of where this money is typically used. What areas of life are going to be affected?
So the largest portion, I would say, would be Indian Health Service. We're a self-governance tribe, so we get to operate our own programs and services in health from the funding that we receive. We receive $30 million a year. We recapture about $10 million additional in insurances and third-party revenue. Other areas that will be affected are childcare, food distribution. We have a general assistance program for people who are looking for work, and this helps to pay their rent. Heating assistance is another area. Head Start and education. All of those areas are going to be ill-affected if the shutdown continues past the couple of weeks.
Have you been getting phone calls or have you been swapping emails with people at other tribes and communities saying, hey, we're starting to panic?
Yes. So while my tribe has taken some measures to be able to withstand a shorter-term government shutdown, and we're talking maybe up to 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, we can survive under that before we have to make drastic cuts. But I have talked with some members of my tribe that are health directors under IHS in different communities across the country, and they're already working on furloughs. There's some layoffs that have already occurred, and also some are working without pay.
I think people forget the extent of this relationship, right, between people on Native lands and the U.S. and these treaties. Can you kind of remind people what that relationship is, how it came to be?
Absolutely. So across the country for the 573 tribes, about 500 million acres of land was traded between tribes and the federal government in exchange for health, education, and social welfare into perpetuity. And in Michigan, the five tribes that signed the 1836 treaty, of which my tribe is a party, we ceded 14 million acres. And so we just expect the federal government to fulfill their treaty and trust responsibility and to follow through. A government is only as good as its word. And some people will ask, why do we follow these antiquated treaty documents? And my response is that they are older, but the Constitution is older. And if we follow and honor our Constitution, we need to also honor the treaties.
Aaron Payman is tribal chairperson of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
The shutdown is happening as the 116th Congress gets underway. There are four new representatives from Michigan, including Representative Alyssa Slotkin of the 8th Congressional District, which includes Lansing. Minutes before her swearing in on Thursday, I talked by phone with Representative Slotkin. She talked about the shutdown, President Trump's wall, and her plans to open an office in Lansing. We'll start with her swearing in.
It feels great. It's exciting. We have a fantastic class. Everyone's got their family here. But it's a huge responsibility. And we all are, you know, this isn't just a day of celebration. We get sworn in and then we just start taking votes, a rules package, but then trying to put together a package to open the government. And I don't think there could be a more important thing for us to do as new members of Congress than to get the darn government started. So we're getting to work.
In November, you told me that you didn't want Nancy Pelosi as the House Speaker. Are you disappointed that it looks like that will happen?
Well, she's going to be our next speaker. And, you know, this was never for me personal. I don't want to be disrespectful to anyone who has served. But for me, it was really important that we expand the number of leaders who actually pay attention to Midwestern issues, jobs, the economy, wages, healthcare. And I think party leadership in general needs to be focusing more on that and talking more about that if we're going to earn people's votes. So I'm going to work with her. I'm going to work with everyone in leadership. I'm a pragmatist. And again, it wasn't personal, but I personally will not be supporting her on the floor today.
If you were able to visit the White House and sit in the office with President Trump, what would you tell him as a new member of Congress?
I would say, let's figure out a way that we can both improve security along the border. You know, let's talk about border agents. Let's talk about, technology. Let's talk about, in some limited areas, if there needs to be some additional fencing, then let's put up a fence. But let's do it from a perspective of practicality and what is actually needed rather than hanging on to something that was political. You know, this started as a political conversation. He said we needed a full concrete wall and Mexico was going to pay for it. It's something he clearly feels very attached to. But if you care about the security of the country, then you get to work, refund or fund the Department of Homeland Security and hammer out a deal.
What issues specific to the Lansing area will you be tackling now that you've taken the oath?
Well, so the first thing is we're opening our Lansing office, right? So we have to have a place where we can actually hear from people, talk about the issues that affect people on the ground, talk about how legislation in Washington affects people on the ground. So we were able today, once I'm signed in or sworn in, to sign a lease in Lansing. I'm going to get sworn in Lansing on the 13th of January, and we're going to be open for constituent services right after that. So that, to me, is the most immediate and proximate thing that's going to affect the Lansing community. We'll also have satellite offices at least in Rochester and then someone covering Livingston County. And then, you know, we've got to have a conversation, first and foremost, I think, about restoring integrity to our system. So campaign finance reform and government accountability. It affects Lansing because I can't tell you how many young people I talked to who said, you know, I don't vote. I think our system's broken and I don't want to participate. And we cannot allow that to go on. We have to take this for what it is. It's a crisis, and bring back a measure of integrity to our government.
Representative Alyssa Slotkin, thank you so much and congratulations on this day.
Thanks for having me. Take care now.
In late Friday, Representative Slotkin said she would not accept her congressional salary during the federal government shutdown. Instead, she will donate the money to the Alzheimer's Association. Next, new revelations in the Larry Nassar case.
People deserve to know the truth. When you look at this case, it's very complex.
An investigative reporter shares the information you may have missed over the holidays. Also, now that recreational marijuana is legal in Michigan, we will tell you how police are detecting drug-impaired driving. And later, plenty of heat for a Spartan coach. You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. You're listening to Current State from WKAR. If you were traveling during the holidays, you may have missed some significant news regarding the Larry Nassar sexual abuse investigation. Days before Christmas, a special prosecutor accused Michigan State University of stonewalling his investigation into the school's handling of the sexual abuse scandal. Bill Forsyth released a report that accuses MSU of fighting the release of certain relevant documents and releasing others that were heavily redacted or irrelevant. Alexander Illich is a former TV reporter in the Lansing area and an MSU grad. She received some other documents and tweeted out that information, which caught the eye of many. First, we asked her to outline some of her reports that she shared online.
When Michigan State University fired Larry Nassar in September of 2016, the university said it was because he failed to follow new guidelines put into place after he became the subject of a 2014 Title IX investigation. Nassar was required to follow those guidelines, according to MSU, after he and his boss, former MSU Dean William Strample, agreed to them before he returned to his clinical duties. However, emails and handwritten notes from Amanda Tomasho's 2014 Title IX investigation revealed that Strample wasn't the only one who was made aware of them. Handwritten notes from Christine Moore, who was the Title IX investigator, show that other individuals, including Jeffrey Covan and Terry Curry, were also informed. Jeffrey Covan is the team doctor for MSU's basketball, soccer, track, and softball teams. Terry Curry is the associate provost and associate vice president for academic human resources.
Amanda Tomasho is an MSU graduate and the first sexual abuse survivor to file a Title IX complaint against Larry Nassar. Normally, WKAR does not identify sexual abuse victims, but Tomasho has spoken publicly with the New York Times, CNN, and other outlets about her assault.
Some of the documents I've obtained as part of that 2014 Title IX investigation show Moore's notes that she wrote while she was investigating Amanda Thomas-Show's complaint. And they reveal that William Strample wasn't the only one that knew about the policies, which is something that the university has said all along, that William Strample, Larry Nassar's former boss, was the only one that was told about these new guidelines put into place that came as a result of Amanda Thomas-Show's 2014 Title IX investigation. And so as part of these guidelines, three new steps that Larry said he was going to take as a result of this, which included having a resident in the room when he was seeing a patient and performing the medical procedure that Amanda Thomas-Show said was a sexual assault.
And the reporter, Alexandra Illich, joins us in studio now. Why is this information significant that you shared online?
So it's worth mentioning that William Strample is facing charges related specifically to the fact that he knew about these policies. Now, there are a couple charges that are unrelated to this, but among those charges are willful neglect of duty for the way he handled that situation. And so if there are more individuals that are copied on emails that were also made aware of this, these policies, but only William Strample is being held accountable for them, you just wonder. I do understand, and I'm sure everyone understands, that William Strample was the boss of Larry Nassar, but these handwritten notes and other documents are saying that he isn't the only one that was responsible for making sure Larry knew about these policies, making sure that there was this understanding that he had to follow them. And so when you consider the fact that, you know, he's being charged for this and he's the only one, it just raises more questions than answers.
So we know the Attorney General did release more information in December. Did you ask them why they did not include this new information in their report?
I did. And the response that I got from a spokeswoman for the Attorney General's office was that the report released by the Attorney General's office right before Christmas was not a final report. She said that it was, quote, entirely possible that additional information could come to light that could result in additional charges. So then she also went on to say that the status update, which is what the Attorney General's office gave, is required to comply to ethics standards for open litigation, also adding that there's information that cannot be disclosed. So I did ask about these handwritten notes simply because the Attorney General's office referenced them in the status update. The spokeswoman did not say whether this information could be the information that could possibly result in additional charges.
Has there been any sort of response from the university?
When I asked Michigan State University about this information, a spokeswoman reiterated the same statement that the university released on December 21st after the Attorney General's office released its status update. And in the statement that MSU sent to me, they're sorry that Larry Nassar was on MSU's campus, saying, quote, the university is engaged in and investing in an intense reform and cultural change effort to ensure that Michigan State University is a safe campus for students, faculty, staff, and our community. Today's announcement, which was December 21st, shows that the Attorney General's office has found no criminal conduct beyond the formally charged, even after reviewing more than a half million documents and interviewing 500 people. The university said they appreciate the Attorney General's office's investigation and the hard work of the many people involved.
So if people want to see these documents for themselves, where can they find them?
If you go on my Twitter, I posted a few pages with these notes included. Some of them are included in there with kind of a breakdown of some of the information that we're talking about, which show some of the emails that Larry was sending to William Strample and the Title IX investigator.
What is your Twitter handle?
It is at Alexandra Illich.
Before we let you go, when is the next hearing for former MSU President Luana K. Simon?
She is due back in an Eaton County courtroom later this month.
And remind us, what is she charged with?
Luana K. Simon is facing two felony and two misdemeanor counts of lying to police. The Attorney General's office has alleged that Simon lied to police when asked about whether she knew it was specifically Larry Nassar that was being investigated in 2014. They're saying that she said no, she did not know that it was Larry Nassar, rather a university sports medicine doctor. But the Attorney General's office is saying that they have evidence that points otherwise.
Why are you so passionate about making sure this story is covered?
People deserve to know the truth. When you look at this case, it's very complex. There are a lot of individuals who've been affected by it. I believe it's important to know and understand what may have went wrong, and then be able to learn from it to make sure that history doesn't repeat itself.
And we've been speaking with reporter Alexandra Illich about the Nassar case and MSU investigation. Thank you so much for coming in and updating us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Current State here on WKAR. Now that recreational marijuana is legal in Michigan, police may be on extra alert for drug-impaired driving. That means an elite group of officers who have received the highest level of training for drug detection may soon be in big demand. Laura Michaels has more.
In the state of Michigan, the most highly trained officers as it relates to the detection of drug and alcohol impaired driving are drug recognition experts. State Trooper Greg Primo is a DRE. He says DREs receive intensive teaching that includes correctly identifying which drugs actual people under arrest have taken.
They'll perform this 12-step evaluation on these arrested subjects, and their opinion has to be accurate as to what the urine sample says.
According to the Michigan State Police, DREs receive more than 110 hours of training to receive certification. In East Lansing, I'm Laura Michaels.
The Oregon Ducks defeated Michigan State football days ago, and many Spartans say one man is to blame.
In my experience here in East Lansing covering sports at Michigan State University, no. I have not seen a backlash like this.
We will get Al Martin's take coming up. And what happens when you mix violin music and humor? Learn about our classical new release of the month just ahead on Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR. On the eve of students returning for Michigan State University's spring semester, there's a lot of talk about MSU basketball and football. So, of course, we had to bring in WKAR's current sports host, Al Martin. Hello, Al.
How you doing, Reg?
I'm great. First, let's talk about the fallout from the Red Box Bowl. MSU losing to the Oregon Ducks 7-6. A lot of people upset with offensive coordinator Dave Warner. Why?
Well, simply put, the offense was horrible, Reg. I mean, this was an offense that could not move the football. This was an offense that had a quarterback controversy when it comes to Rocky Lombardi and Brian Lewerke. The offensive line couldn't get any push to open up things for that run game. And, you know, in some kind of defense for Dave Warner, there were a lot of injuries. That was certainly well documented throughout this year. But Dave Warner's job is to get this offense ready from Saturday to Saturday. And his play calling was very predictable, very vanilla. And it's something that we've seen. It's a pattern now that we've seen throughout his tenure as offensive coordinator for Michigan State football. So you waste a top-tier defense that on any given year, if you have just an average offense, could have given you a shot to add to that trophy case. And you spoil that kind of defense with this inept offense that falls on Dave Warner.
Let's talk about a few of the nicer tweets that we can read on air. Just one reads, just leave Dave Warner at the airport, probably talking to Mark D'Antonio when he was still in San Francisco. Another said, can you arrest Dave Warner for public indecency? Putting together an offense that bad has to be some sort of crime. Another wrote, Happy New Year to everyone except Dave Warner.
Oh, that's tough, Ridge.
In your experience, Al, have you ever seen fallout like this? And is Dave Warner going anywhere?
In my experience here in East Lansing covering sports at Michigan State University, no. I have not seen a backlash like this. However, I get it. I mean, I totally get it. I mean, you look at where Michigan State was a few years ago, right? I mean, this was one of the very few teams to reach a college football playoff, playing at AT&T Stadium down in Arlington, Texas. Granted, the blowout loss to Alabama, but still, they got there. You know, a Rose Bowl championship. They've won Big Ten championships. I mean, that's the expectation now here. When you establish that kind of success, fans expect you to come close at least to that kind of success. And when you don't, and when you don't make any changes in the offseason, and you keep around a guy like Dave Warner, who, again, time and time again, has not been able to get that offense ready, criticism is going to come. And I think it is justified. And those tweets are kind of, you know, hilarious. And again, this is the thing about me doing what we do as sports journalists, Reg. I never like to talk about somebody's job, right? But the proof is in the pudding. And if you're not getting the job done, change has to be made.
And do you expect Antonio to make any changes?
Well, if you are going off of past experience, because, you know, Dave Warner has received criticism before, I think it's at a new level right now. D'Antonio is loyal to a fault. You hear that a lot. I mean, D'Antonio loves his guys. He loves his coaching staff. He loves his players, for goodness sake, of course, right? And Dave is his guy. I think that the criticism is so bad right now, and, you know, it's still trending online, and you just read those tweets, that Coach D'Antonio has to do something. I think his hand is being forced now to do something. I think he knows that. He chose not to comment directly after the Red Box Bowl loss to Oregon. And frankly, if he doesn't, we need to start really questioning the leadership of Mark D'Antonio.
Well, we are talking with WKAR current sports host Al Martin about MSU sports. Now let's switch to MSU basketball. I think there are more smiles on that side. We taped this discussion before Saturday's game at Ohio State. This week, the men's team beat Northwestern 81-55. Fans are loving them. What is driving this team, Al?
That's a good question. What's driving this team? I think, you know, I think if you look at last year in second round loss to Syracuse, I mean, with a team that had so much expectation, I think that may be driving this team. And, you know, I think this team wants to prove something to all of those who criticized that early exit from last season, that, you know, we're still Michigan State. We are still one of the top tier programs in the nation. And the big difference for me this season is the chemistry that they have. This team is really gelling right now, Reg. Now, you know, we had this debate this week on current sports. If you were to compare this year's team to last year's team, talent-wise, we all know last year's team was much more talented. I mean, you had two NBA draft lottery picks, for goodness sake, and I think last year's team was Tom Izzo's best team he's ever had here in East Lansing. But this year, this is a unit. This is a clear unit, and they know that they may not have that one guy who can completely dominate a game. So it's a different mindset this year. It's all right, let's really share the ball. Let's really move that thing around and see which matchups we can exploit on any given game, right? So this team is the chemistry is off the charts right now, and that's a point that sophomore forward Xavier Tillman made after that win against Northwestern.
Everybody's just having fun, like in practice, even if we have a two-a-day or something like that, everybody's smiling and having fun. It might seem like rough and tough and all that, but like when we get in the locker room, it's all jokes and it makes it a lot easier on us.
Last year, it seemed from the beginning, folks at MSU going to the Final Four, even President Obama picked them to win. It seems like people are more of a wait-and-see mode, but you have to feel excitement when they're winning by 20, 30 points ahead.
Exactly. And you know, it's still very, very early, Reg. So, you know, I don't want to get Spartan fans too hyped up right now. I mean, we're still in the very preliminary stages of the long Big Ten year, the first year where every team in the Big Ten is going to play a 20-game Big Ten season. Still early. But again, when you look at what happened against Northwestern and you look at how this team has come together so far this year, you got to feel good about it right now. And especially, you know, Nick Ward, he's a guy that did test the NBA draft waters, dipped his toe in, got feedback, and he's really taken that feedback and improved in so many different areas this season. He's really become the catalyst down low for this team, but this team will go. And I said this last year as well, Reg. This team will go as far as starting point guard Cassius Winston takes them. He is the straw that stirs the drink. He is the captain of this ship. When he has a bad game, the entire team has a bad game. I think Izzo had a statement last year, you know, we're a team where if you cut off the head, the body will die. And he's talking about Cassius Winston. Cassius Winston is the head of this team. When he plays well, the Spartans play well. So that's the key player for me this year.
Well, we can't forget about the women. Why are they only ranked 16th? And they're also playing really well.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good ranking right now, Reg, for this team. I mean, even though, you know, they knocked off the number three team in the nation at the time in the Oregon Ducks earlier this season, they've beaten a ranked opponent like Iowa, a very good ranked opponent like Iowa. You know, this team came into the season unranked, you know, a lot of question marks. Because I think primarily because of the fact that they only have one senior, that being Jenna Allen. And nobody, if you haven't seen Spartan fans, Nia Cloudin play, she is the star young point guard for this team, freshman. Check her out. Go to the Breslin Center immediately. She is fearless. She's not afraid to take the big shots. She's aggressive. And I think she's a young leader for this team. She's a pleasure to watch. They just got back Shea Colley as well. So I think that right now being ranked where they are right now, Reg, is a solid ranking for them because it's still so early. And again, yeah, they've beaten some ranked opponents that are really, really good, including number three, Oregon. But, you know, we'll see. They haven't hit their ceiling just yet. So I think it's an accurate rating. We'll see where they are in a couple of weeks because they're just now really getting into Big Ten play. But they've got some great players, and they are fun to watch, really fun to watch.
Well, we know you're staying on top of it. That is WKAR's current sports host, Al Martin. Thank you for joining us.
Anytime, Rich. Thank you.
You can hear him every weekday at 1 p.m. on AM 870 and FM 105.1 WKAR News Talk. Thank you for listening to Current State here on member-supported WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Violinist Ray Chen recently appeared in Michigan as guest soloist with the Flint Symphony Orchestra. Chen is known for his virtuosic playing and his playful sense of musical humor. Now he takes his talents to a new level with his latest recording. Peter Worf has WKAR's January new release of the month.
You know the phrase, the golden age of, applied to a lot of things. It happens to be the title of violinist Ray Chen's newest release, featuring music by great violinists and great violin composers. Ray Chen associates them all with the notion of a golden age.
People might think of the golden age of violin, but however, they might also think of the golden age of something else. Film could be golden age of photography. Golden age could be then, could be in the 20s, 1920s, 1930s, could be in the 1970s, could be now. The golden age is when you make it, with bringing the past forward to create a new golden age. And I think that's really what this album is about.
Sure, Chen's golden age leaves plenty of room for listeners to choose their era of inspiration, but the collection really focuses on the times of 20th century legends like Fritz Kreisler, Yasha Heifetz, and George Gershwin. Gershwin's Summertime to the Fritz Kreisler original Chien Rosmarine, the Golden Age recalls a time when a typical high-level violin recital might include 8 or 10 works or more of wildly different styles. Chen travels that path, taking us from one of the most standard of standards, Max Bruch's Violin Concerto, his string quartet's fresh take on Erik Satie, mm-hmm. Belponte's popular Estrellita and Debussy's Clair de Lune also straddle that late 19th, early 20th century golden era when classical musicians had a bit more courage to wear their hearts on their sleeves. Ray Chen and a few others are starting to bring that idea back into style. Ray Chen's The Golden Age is WKAR's January new release of the month. I'm Peter Dwarf.
We have an exciting new addition to the WKAR Classical lineup. Saturdays at noon, you can tune in to Great Lakes Concerts. WKAR's Scott Pohl talked with classical host Jody Knoll about what this new show is all about.
It's a kind of a cooperative effort between WKAR and WRCJ in Detroit and Interlochen Public Radio, IPR Classical. Classical IPR, get it straight there, and
start getting that right.
I gotta get these right. Yeah, but we're all contributing recordings to it, and I'll be hosting it and producing it. It'll be a weekly series. We'll be airing it on Saturdays at noon, WRCJ Sundays at 10 a.m. and Interlochen Public Radio at 6 p.m. on Mondays. So Saturday, Sunday, Monday. This week is going to be kind of a sampler concert, just to give people an idea of the range of orchestras and the geographic areas that we'll sample from. We'll hear from the Traverse Symphony Orchestra, Baroque on Beaver Festival Orchestra, Beaver Island, the Jackson, Lansing Symphonies, the Michigan Philharmonic, Absolute Music Chamber Series. So a little bit of everything this week.
Is it 1 hour, 2 hours?
1 hour.
1 hour program every week.
Exactly.
Well, it's really exciting, and I'm glad that WKAR is part of an ambitious project like this.
Yeah, and we hope to add some other stations around the state as we can, but right now we're going to have a pretty far reach from Detroit to Traverse City in the north and right here in the Capital Region.
You were just listening to WKAR's Scott Pohl and Jody Knoll. And again, Great Lakes Concerts airs Saturdays at noon on 90.5 WKAR. And thank you for joining us. WKAR's news team features Abigail Sinsky, Kevin Lavery, Laura Michaels, Scott Pohl, Shayna Roth, Jamie Paisley, and Carell Vega. The WKAR radio station manager is Peter Worf. Susie Elkins is WKAR's director of broadcasting. WKAR is part of the College of Communication Arts and Science at Michigan State University. I'm digital news director Reginald Hardwick. Thank you for joining us. For the entire WKAR news team, have a great weekend. We'll connect with you again next time.
It's tough enough to find the right treatment for a child with autism. When a child has both autism and a mental illness, it can be much tougher. I'm WKAR Scott Pohl. Monday on Morning Edition, a mother's fight to help her son. Listen at 6:45 and 8:45 on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.
Public media is one way to reach the most informed and influential people of Michigan. Help us continue the Michigan Minute, local news, and spread your message. Email our corporate gifts manager at Judy, J-U-D-Y, at WKAR.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.